From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nicole Ogrisco with the news on this day in Maine, Monday, May 5th, 2025. Former Governor Paul LePage announced today that he is running for Maine's 2nd congressional district seat. Steve Missler has more.
LePage served 2 terms as Maine's governor and left office in 2019. The same year, Democratic Congressman Jared Golden kicked off his first term. Now LePage is seeking to challenge Golden for a seat that the Democrat has managed to hold despite skewing conservative since President Donald Trump was first elected in 2016. LePage's expected candidacy would mark the 2nd time that he's tried to get back into politics. He challenged and lost to Governor Janet Mills in 2022 and blamed his defeat on the contest's focus on abortion rights. The Republican was also criticized for retiring to Florida before briefly returning to challenge Mills. LePage is a Lewiston native whose rough upbringing was a central feature of his campaigns. As governor, he aggressively pursued tax and welfare cuts and an antagonistic approach to political opponents. He has often been described as a Trump prototype. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The Mills administration is asking lawmakers to hold off on a bill that would force fossil fuel companies to pay for climate damages. Department of Environmental Protection head Melanie Loizom says regulators want to see how other states roll out similar measures and handle lawsuits to block them. Vermont and New York have passed similar laws. Supporters say the bill will hold major greenhouse gas polluters accountable for the harms of a warming climate. But opponents say the measure unfairly targets oil, gas, and coal companies and will increase consumer costs.
Adopting some version of a climate superfund in Maine now creates an administrative burden for the department to develop a program that may be struck down by judges in the coming year. The last couple of insane weeks of committee work is not the right time to pass into law something of this significance.
Supporters say the bill will hold major greenhouse gas polluters accountable for the harms of a warming climate. But opponents say the measure unfairly targets oil, gas, and coal companies and will increase consumer costs. The Maine Legislature's Veterans and Legal Affairs Committee considered 9 cannabis-related bills today, including 2 proposals that seek to strengthen safety requirements. Patty White reports.
Out of the more than 30 states with medical cannabis programs, Maine is the only one that doesn't require testing for mold, pesticides, and heavy metals. The 2 bills on the table would change that. Supporters include Maine's Office of Cannabis Policy, physician and public health organizations, and some cannabis growers. John Brady, co-founder of Brilliant Buds, reminded lawmakers that a recent state audit found that more than 40% of medical cannabis tested had at least 1 contaminant.
If I came before you today and said I have a product that I want to sell to immunocompromised patients, and it's 42% would fail testing for either a pesticide or heavy metals, would this committee say yes, we'll approve that product?
But opponents argued that the proposals would do little to protect public health, but would impose expensive regulations that would put small growers out of business. Medical cannabis caregiver Emily Baldwin says she left California because of its regulations and moved to Aroostook County.
Patients deserve a safe and reliable legal market. To achieve that, we need balanced regulations, ones that protect consumers without bankrupting the very people who grow and process their medicine.
One of the proposals also calls for a study on how to reduce high-risk cannabis use by adolescents. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Maine arts organizations learned Friday that their grant funding from the National Endowment for the Arts has been terminated. David East, the executive director at the Watershed Center for the Ceramic Art in Newcastle, says his organization receives 2 NEA grants totaling more than $60,000, one which was terminated Friday. Another has been under review since the federal funding freeze was announced in January.
Part of the difficulty through this whole time period is the complete lack of transparency or actual quick answers from the NEA.
Whitney Gill with the Maine Crafts Association says her grants have also been under review. And while a craft apprenticeship program continued this year without funding, she's not sure it would be able to in the future without this money. Both East and Gill say they have reached out to the NEA and have received no meaningful explanation for the delay. Maine Governor Janet Mills and five other northeastern governors are inviting six Canadian premiers to participate in a summit to discuss cross-border relations and President Donald Trump's tariffs. Steve Missler brings us this additional report.
The invitation comes as the region's governors try to maintain their close relationship with Canada in trade, energy, and tourism as the president pursues tough tariffs and threats of annexation not seen since President William McKinley. Canadian leaders have responded with a nationalist posture, boycotting American vacation destinations and discussing moving away from the U.S. as an economic partner. That's a big concern in Maine, where Canada is the state's largest trading partner and where tourism officials are predicting a 25% drop-off for the upcoming summer season. Border crossing data already shows signs of decreased passenger car traffic from Canada into Maine. Governors from New York and every New England state except New Hampshire extended the invitation to the premiers of Canada's six eastern provinces. The summit is expected to take place in Boston at a later date. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Environmental advocates and Penobscot Nation citizens rallied in Old Town yesterday against the proposed expansion of the Juniper Ridge landfill. Casella Waste Management, which operates the state-owned landfill, is seeking to expand its capacity and extend its contract. Last year, the Maine Department of Environmental Protection ruled the expansion met state public benefit criteria, although the Penobscot Nation and Conservation Law Foundation are appealing that decision in Superior Court. Darren Ranko is a Penobscot Nation citizen and chair of Native American programs at the University of Maine.
Penobscot people will never give up, will never stop caring. No matter what the state does, no matter what Casella does, we will be here fighting.
The speakers also highlighted bills in the legislature that would require legislative approval for Juniper Ridge's contract renewal and require further testing of landfill leachate for PFAS. After 45 years of service, the York County shelter is expected to close by the end of this week due to a lack of funding, according to its board of directors. Carol Bousquet reports.
York County Shelter Programs Board spokeswoman Kelly DeVoe says the operation's $5 million annual budget did not cover all expenses. While it costs $102 a night per shelter resident, the state reimbursement is $7 a night. DeVoe says people are asking, how did this happen and who's to blame? But she says there's no villain.
These are the people who are working to make a better life for themselves. They're looking to find a home and stability. Our employees have genuinely changed lives. Our hope is that ultimately there's another chapter here.
DeVoe says there are now efforts underway to extend the stay of the 56 adults living at the shelter. 20 staffers were let go Thursday, but some remain to serve those residents. The board of directors is also hoping other agencies can pick up some shelter programs, such as the food pantry that feeds 6,000 people a month. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Carol Bousquet.
A scallop farmer in Penobscot Bay is looking to double the size of his operation under what would be the largest lease for a scallop farm in Maine. Andrew Peters, owner of Vertical Bay, says he's seeking a larger lease from the Maine Department of Marine Resources in order to sell more scallops and sustain his business.
Yeah, we're just trying to grow our space, basically, what we can have. And also, you know, on top of that, improve our methods and have, you know, less mortality and try to fit more scallops on the farm in a more efficient manner.
Peters had applied for a 40-acre lease with a 20-year lease period. He says he hopes to be a model for other fishermen who may be trying to diversify their business and start scallop farming. A lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice against Maine over transgender athletes appears headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But legal experts say it's unclear where the high court would come down on the issue. In the latest installment of Maine's Political Pulse, Kevin Miller dives into the history of the law known as Title IX and how it fits into an evolving legal and political war over transgender rights.
37 words. That's the entire length of the non-discrimination law known as Title IX. Passed by Congress in 1972, Title IX helped to level the playing field between men and women in the classroom and in athletics by prohibiting discrimination, quote, on the basis of sex. But there have been decades of debate about what those three dozen words explicitly say and don't say. The law has been tweaked by Congress, modified by the courts, and reinterpreted by multiple presidential administrations.
The state of Maine is discriminating against women by failing to protect women in women's sports. Pretty basic stuff.
That's U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi announcing last month that the Department of Justice had filed suit against Maine over the state's policy allowing transgender athletes to compete in girls' and women's sports.
This is a violation of Title IX. The Department of Justice will not sit by when women are discriminated against in sports.
Over the last 9 years alone, transgender Americans were granted protections by President Obama under Title IX, then lost those protections during Trump's first term, regained them during the Biden administration, and then lost them again within weeks of Trump's return to the Oval Office. Some institutions, like the NCAA, quickly complied with Trump's executive order banning transgender athletes from girls and women's sports. But Maine and other states that prohibit discrimination based on gender identity have yet to follow suit. And the Maine Department of Education has the distinction of being slapped with the administration's first federal lawsuit over the issue last month.
The president issued an executive order saying he had a certain interpretation of Title IX and demanding that that be adhered to.
Andrew Rudalevich is a professor of government at Bowdoin College who has written extensively about presidential power and authority. Rudalevich points out that executive orders don't change the law. They merely interpret it. So he says the courts are the appropriate venue for this debate to play out over Title IX's application to transgender individuals.
I don't have a good sense, right, of the likely outcome of that, to be honest. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made, but certainly President Trump's interpretation is not the only one that's ever been offered and doesn't become law simply on his say-so.
There has not been a definitive Supreme Court decision on the question.
Aaron Bazouvis is a professor and associate dean at Western New England University School of Law in Massachusetts, who specializes in gender and discrimination law in education and athletics.
There is lower court case law about this. Many courts have ruled in favor of trans athletes. There have been some that have not.
Bazouvis and some other legal scholars see clear parallels between the looming Title IX fight and another case that did make it to the Supreme Court in 2020. In Bostock versus Clayton County, the court ruled 6-3 that the employment law, known as Title VII, prohibits discrimination based on gender identity. Bazouvis says that decision is helpful and applicable, but doesn't guarantee a similar outcome on Title IX.
That said, I think there are very strong arguments that the same underlying rationale that clarified that sex discrimination encompasses transgender discrimination in employment ought to apply in the athletics context as well.
It was one of Trump's Supreme Court picks, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion in the Bostock case. Chief Justice and fellow conservative John Roberts joined him and four left-leaning justices in ruling that Title VII prohibits discrimination against transgender workers. But the court has grown more conservative since then. Rutgers University Law School professor Katie Iyer wrote one of the textualist legal papers that reportedly influenced Gorsuch when he wrote the prevailing opinion in the employment law case.
I am not confident what the court will do if and when the Title IX issue reaches it. You know, if you just count the votes based on Bostock, you might think the votes are there, but I'm not sure that that is actually going to turn out to be true.
Iyer specializes in anti-discrimination law, especially as it pertains to LGBTQ employment rights. And she agrees with Bazouvis that the same arguments that applied to that Bostock case in 2020 should apply to Title IX because the language is so similar.
Title VII says because of sex. Title IX says on the basis of sex. The Supreme Court have said on numerous occasions that those phrases mean exactly the same thing.
Of course, not everyone agrees.
The language of both statutes is different.
Sarah Parshall Perry provided legal counsel to the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights during the first Trump term. She now serves as vice president and senior fellow at Defending Education, a conservative national group that supports bans on transgender athletes. Parshall Perry says the two laws have different approaches. One expressly prohibits sex-based discrimination in the workplace, while the other requires schools to provide equal access to educational and athletic programming. And she says it's clear that both Congress and the women's groups pushing for Title IX in the 1970s were focused on, quote, biological sex.
And the fact that Congress's original purpose would be frustrated by expansion to include gender identity or transgender status, I think argue very strongly for the fact that the administration has correctly interpreted this longstanding federal civil rights law.
It's unclear whether the lawsuit filed against Maine will be the one to land in front of the Supreme Court, given the court's broad discretion for choosing cases. The justices often wait for conflicting rulings from lower appellate courts. But the legal experts say Maine's case is a top candidate because it involves the Department of Justice, as well as questions of state sovereignty and presidential powers. Either way, Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry recently told NPR's Here and Now program that his team has been gearing up for this fight for months.
We were prepared to defend ourselves in court on this because we are confident in our read on Title IX and on the Maine Human Rights Act and what's required of our state.
Meanwhile, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi continues to assert that Trump's interpretation is the correct one.
Well, they must not be reading the same Title IX that we're reading.
Soon, it could be the courts that will decide whose Title IX interpretation is correct. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Kevin Miller.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, Shakers in Maine. I'm Nicole Ogrisco. Thanks for listening.